European leaders have a plan.
Will it solve the debt crisis?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Thursday, October 27th.
Coming up, the economy is growing, and so is animosity about debt reduction.
What happened to Nintendo? A podcast exclusive coming up.
And later, the perfect gift for a person, Jeremy, who has everything, like... Oh, a moat or a river.
Oh, yes, those people. Yeah, I know a lot of them. Those stories ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
European leaders have agreed to measures that will ease the European debt crisis. For one, investors have voluntarily agreed to take a 50% loss on their investments in Greek debt. Now, taking those losses will mean that European banks will also be required to raise more money, more capital, to strengthen their balance sheet. And the Eurozone's main bailout fund will increase its capacity to $1.4 trillion. We begin our coverage today with the BBC's Andrew Walker, who joins us now from Brussels, where this deal was sort of put together and these finance ministers from all over Europe were. Hi, Andrew.
Hello there.
Will this be enough, do you think, to save the Eurozone?
It'll certainly make a big difference in the short term. But there's an awful lot of detail that needs to be filled in, a lot of it highly technical. And I have to say, an awful lot of people think that even more firepower, more financial firepower, would have been a great deal more convincing. Some people think that what it really needs is to get the European Central Bank explicitly involved as a lender to the bailout agency, which would then lend on to governments. That, however, is very unpopular in Germany, and so it's not being agreed.
What's been the reaction, besides what you said about Germany, across Europe this morning?
Financial markets have certainly taken it very well. There's been a marked rise in most share prices. I think across the European Union there's a degree of relief that some deal has been done. But I think inevitably people are going to start asking questions about what the detail really is, whether it is a durable solution to Europe's problems or just a temporary stopgap.
The BBC's Andrew Walker in Brussels. Andrew, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, let's get some reaction now from Adolfo Laurenti. He is deputy chief economist with Mesirow Financial. He's filling in for Diane Swonk this morning, and he joins us from Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Adolfo, first, do you think that this deal is going to be enough to prevent any future summits among European leaders to deal with the debt crisis?
Well, Jeremy, we have been a partner before, so I would be cautious to use words as like game changer of a solution of blockbuster. Hmm. But this is a step in the right direction. I think it's a deal that touches on all the major important issues that Europe is confronting: the default of Greece, the recapitalization of banks, contagion to Italy and Spain. It seems to be credible and realistic. So I'm on the positive and optimistic side this morning.
And I saw that the Greek prime minister is heading back to Greece tonight to address his people. What does this mean for the people around Europe? Have you been in touch with friends or family in Italy, for instance? What are they saying about this?
Yes, there have been a lot of concern. I have friends in Greece that have already seen the real suffering that the crisis have taken on their country. In Italy, there is a lot of concerns about what the future may have for them. So I think that the European leaders have a lot of explaining to really give some confidence to these populaces that have been really, really scared about what we have seen on the markets in the past couple of years.
Well, you say they need more confidence. I mean, is it different from people here in this country who may feel that they are being held back? They don't have the opportunity that they feel that they should have because of what's going on a macroeconomic level.
Well, there is a shared sense of uncertainty between Europe and in the United States, but I think there is a fundamental difference. In the United States, we see anger because people were used to have economic opportunities, and now they don't see them, or at least they are very, very slow to come back after the recession. In Europe, economic opportunities have been missing for a very long time. People are missing hopes, and that's very worrisome for the future.
Adolfo Laurenti, Deputy Chief Economist at Mesirow Financial, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
One more take, Jeremy and Adolfo, from an American perspective now. Richard DeKayser is deputy chief economist at the Parthenon Group. He's with us from Boston. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Now that this European deal is done, what does it mean for the United States?
Well, the good news is that the worst-case scenario of a financial crisis has been averted. People had feared a uncontrolled default situation. That now does not seem likely. Banks have agreed to a voluntary write-down of Greek debt, and that's going to be supported by a stability fund, which Europe has agreed to beef up.
All right, so they're going to beef up the stability fund, and I know as part of this deal, European banks are going to have to raise a lot of money. In this environment, this economy, how big a challenge is that?
Well, it is a challenge. Banks are essentially being asked to increase their capitalization to accommodate these increased losses. And there's two ways banks can do that. Either they can earn their way through it, they can borrow their way through it. It looks like we're going to opt for the second of those two. And that means they're going to likely be more parsimonious with lending over the course of the next year. They've got to reach these targets by June of next year. And to do that, we're likely to see not quite a credit crunch, but stringent credit, which is not going to be conducive to growth in an economy that's already creeping along.
Something that we're used to here. All right. Richard DeKayser joining us this morning from Boston. Richard, thanks.
My pleasure.
Well, all this week, we're helping you understand why Greece is such a threat to the global economy and why you should care. Today, young Greeks say there aren't many work prospects at home, so some decide to come to the United States. But of course, the jobless rate is very high here, too. That's why some Greek nationals in New York feel torn about whether to encourage their friends back home to come join them. Sally Herships reports.
Ellen Athena Katsakeas is Greek-American. Born here, high school there, college here. After graduating in the mid-90s, Katsakeas wasn't able to break into the film business. At the time, Greece was booming, so she went back.
We all actually had a very good quality of life. It wasn't too shabby to be able to, you know, go to Greek islands for the weekend, you know.
But 10 glorious years later, the money started drying up. Katsakeas had been working as a freelance film director.
What seemed to be a system that worked, you know, you might wait 2 or 3 months for your pay, but you knew you were going to get it. Suddenly you were up against companies that were maybe paying 6 months down the line, 7 months down the line.
So she packed up her bags and headed for her second home, the States. Professionally, it's worked out for her, but she was sad to leave.
I think we all, when we went there, wanted to be a part of making Greece better. We all brought our degrees and our masters, or certain people brought their PhDs, and we wanted to reverse the brain drain. But I think the brain drain is happening again.
As evidenced by all the calls New York City resident Larissa Antipa is getting from her homeland.
Would you tell people now to come here?
Ah, that's a tricky question.
Antipa first came to the States to study drama. Now she works at the Greek Cultural Center in Queens.
Sure, you can come to the United States, but don't think this is like, you know, heaven also, job-wise.
She says America was more promising 10 years ago when she arrived. Then you didn't need connections to find work. But now?
When you first come here and you don't know anybody, right now, at this moment, it's a big, big difference not knowing anybody and trying to find a job.
And Ellen Katsakeas agrees with Antipa. She says, except for people who are willing to take big steps back in their careers, America may no longer be the promised land. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
We found out this morning that the nation's economy grew at an annual rate of 2.5% in the third quarter. Today's initial GDP report will maybe quiet some fears of a recession, but it's still way below the growth that we need to reduce unemployment.
The government also reported slightly fewer people filed for unemployment claims last week, Jeremy. And here in Southern California today, thousands of people are expected to participate in a job fair. It's taking place just east of L.A. in San Bernardino County, which is a county that's been hit really hard by the economic downturn. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins has a look now at whether job fairs like this one are effective at putting people back to work.
A couple dozen officials are taking a tour of an old airport terminal that today will be transformed into a job fair with over 100 employers in Southern California.
One more thing. We ordered orange and black tablecloths this year, so we're going to kind of be festive.
One organizer, Nick DeMartz of San Bernardino County, says he hopes the event will help bring down the area's 12.9% unemployment.
It's a great way to bring these employers together in one location and bring 2,000 or 3,000 people in.
But John Challenger of the outplacement firm Challenger, Gray and Christmas says they rarely make a match. In a survey of human resources executives,
job fairs ranked as the least effective job search method.
On a scale of 1 to 5, they scored 1.6, behind cold calling employers or blindly sending out resumes. Chris Collins directs the Center for Advanced HR Studies at Cornell University. He says it's tough to stand out against a sea of other candidates.
When you only have a minute to shake someone's hand and pass them a resume, the standard job fair is not a very good way to make that happen.
It's like speed dating or something.
It is worse than speed dating because you have even less time.
San Bernardino County's Nick DeMartz says at least it's something.
If I'm the person who's unemployed and I come to this job fair, and even if I was able to now earn $20,000 a year to feed my family, well, that single person's earnings is more than the entire cost of this job fair.
The event, by the way, cost around $8,000, mostly for chairs, tables, and refreshments. Pretty much everything else is donated. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
The Congressional Super Committee working out a debt reduction plan by just before Thanksgiving appears to be stuck. With dueling plans released yesterday from Democrats and Republicans, it's clear it won't be easy for lawmakers to reach agreement on what cuts should be made. So what happens next? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
There are rumblings from credit rating agencies that the U.S. could be downgraded again if the super committee can't reach a deficit-cutting deal, because the automatic cuts that would be triggered wouldn't take effect until 2013, after the next elections. The new members of Congress could try to prevent the cuts, but a managing director at S&P told Bloomberg any watering down of the deficit cutting could cause a downgrade. Len Blum is managing partner at Westwood Capital. He says another downgrade is quite possible, but not the end of the world.
Long term, I don't know if it matters. You can see from the last downgrade, Treasury is still able to sell their debt. The interest rates are still low. What really matters right now is that we focus on getting people back to work.
But don't look to the government to help with that. The deficit cutting means more government workers and contractors could lose their jobs. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Time Warner Cable is reporting this morning it made about $356 million in profit last year. But when you dig deeper into their earnings report, you might conclude that it's time for the company to change its name to Time Warner Internet. Because the growth is in high-speed data subscriptions, not cable, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Time Warner Cable has been losing more than 100,000 customers every quarter. Robert Thompson is a professor of TV and pop culture at Syracuse University.
Between paying your rent or your grocery bill and cutting off cable, you know, it becomes one of the things that has got to go.
Thompson says the other problem is that young people aren't signing up.
Very few have cable because they watch all of their television on their laptops, unfortunately sometimes during my lectures.
Still, there is a bright spot. Larry Gerbrandt is an analyst with Media Valuation.
When you consider tens of millions of Americans who are unemployed, you would have expected that the losses would be far higher.
Gerbrandt says cable companies have bundled up broadband with cable packages. He says high-speed internet is sure to grow. And he says cable companies have created high-quality content that people will want, even if they buy it to watch on their computers. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Now to a bridge on Highway 80 in southeastern Kentucky that has been there for 82 years, Steve.
Yeah.
But now the bridge is not strong enough to handle all the traffic that passes through the area, so it's being replaced. The problem is it is a historic bridge, and officials don't want to demolish it, so they are literally giving it away.
Giving it away.
Yes. So if you need a 450-foot bridge and you promise to reassemble and maintain it, the state will dismantle it and deliver it to you for free. The deadline to apply, by the way, is December 20th. So maybe it's a perfect Christmas gift for that person who has everything.
Didn't we do a story about the brothers that stole the bridge in Pennsylvania?
Not long ago, the people stole a bridge. So now they can have it for free.
They can have it for free.
But the problem is, of course, they stole the bridge to melt it down for the for the value of what was in it. And this one, you have to promise you will actually maintain.
Yes. So, Jeremy, do you remember this?
I do. I remember that quite fondly, as a matter of
That's,
fact.
That's Super Mario. Yeah, we all do. And today we found out, sadly, Nintendo said it expects to lose money for the first time ever. The inventor of everything from Super Mario Brothers to the Wii Fit is blaming the loss on lagging hardware and on software sales, too. Apparently, a strong Japanese yen is also to blame because that makes Nintendo products more expensive to buy outside of Japan.
Well, in today's Midday Extra, we ask, what happened to Nintendo? Here to speak with us about that is Jeff Ryan, author of the book Super Mario, How Nintendo Conquered America. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, guys. How are you doing?
Very good. So how did Nintendo get into this situation?
I think the big problem is that they appeal to casual gamers more than core gamers. If you think of the people playing Battlefield and Modern Warfare on PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360, those are the core gamers. Mm. And Nintendo's going for a more casual audience. That's been their bread and butter for the last 10 years. But if you're walking around with a smartphone in your pocket, you have an even better device to play casual games with than a $250 3DS.
Is the company, Jeff, defined by American consumers, or can it try to find other markets too? I mean, how does it work with Nintendo?
Well, Nintendo is hitting the whole world, and it found a new market about 10 years ago with this casual audience, people that weren't normally buying video games because even though they played games, they didn't consider themselves core gamers who stayed up until 3 in the morning. They just wanted to play for 5 or 10 minutes, and Nintendo has made a huge amount of money on them, and now their problem is Apple is doing it better. Apple is letting them play for only a dollar to get a game like Angry Birds, which if you do the math, a dollar now is about a quarter back then, which is how much it cost to play a game like Donkey Kong back in 1981. Yeah.
So this is really about smartphones. I mean, that's what's causing, not the Xbox or the other things that are really competing with Nintendo like that. But this is about people walking around with Angry Birds and Solitaire and whatever else.
Tetris.
Right. That's been Nintendo's new consumer base. Their 3DS was trying to do something new. Now, Nintendo's DS, which is their Game Boy that you could have a touchscreen on, that came out a year before the iPhone. So they were first to market with the idea that you could play games using a touchscreen. What they tried to do now with the 3DS was 3D video games, which you can do using this device, but people didn't seem to want it.
Is there a way for the company to turn this around, Jeff?
They have a new product coming out next year called the Wii U. It's basically the big thing about it is it's a tablet touchscreen. So when you're playing, instead of just holding a controller, you have a screen in your hands as well, and you can touch the screen. And what you see on the TV isn't the same as what you're seeing on the screen.
Wow.
When you talk about a tablet, I'm still watching every one of these companies try to compete with Apple, but they're all a step behind, right? I mean, isn't that going to be a problem for Nintendo if they're just sort of following the lead of other companies?
You're not the first person to think that the Wii U may not be the most dynamic forward for them.
I mean, hopefully it is, but I don't know. You know, it doesn't sound like it's so innovative.
And does that preclude it from making money in the first place, right? I mean, even if you can't compete with Apple, you can still make some money, right?
Yes. I mean, Pokemon is one of the most successful feathers in Nintendo's cap. And if you look at it, it's a game that's at least one or two generations behind everything else that's on the market. It's incredibly simple, but the rules are complex enough that you go on for decades playing this game. And they've made boatloads of money with Pokemon, which by anything, if you put it on paper, does not look like it should sell.
Okay, Mew.
Jeff Ryan, author of the book Super Mario, How Nintendo Conquered America. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Well, today is the first day of the Fort Lauderdale International Boat Show. There's $3 billion worth of giant boats and accessories on display at the South Florida show right now. Organizers expect tens of thousands to check out all the tricked out yachts from station WLRN in Miami. Kenny Malone reports.
Andrew Duhl is a lead organizer for the boat show. He's reluctant to call this an out-and-out yacht show.
We have a cross-section of boats that range from dinghies to $60, $80 million yachts.
But he'll also admit the big boats with fireplaces, libraries, and helicopter landing pads are the big draw.
From the engines that go in the boat to gold-plated bathroom fixtures, that's really everything you'd need for a super yacht.
Yachts have an $18 billion ripple effect on Florida's economy. Nikki Grossman heads up the Greater Fort Lauderdale Convention and Visitors Bureau. Can you tell when it's boat show time? I mean, do you see a lot more navy blue blazers or like docksider shoes? What is?
Well, these are people who are fit and they're tan and they look like they're here for a good time, and they certainly are. But they bring a great wealth of fun and excitement and, quite frankly, money.
Grossman says that by just hosting that wave of yacht lovers, Fort Lauderdale gets its own $400 million economic ripple effect. I'm Kenny Malone for Marketplace.
Finally today, a man in Maine, Jeremy, is celebrating 1 million miles registered on his 1990 Honda Accord.
Wow. Yeah. That is, see, now I've heard Honda Accords can go for a long time, but yeah, that is really
I had an Acura that went 250.
Miles. Wow.
I went 250K in my Acura. I remember that. And it was a milestone, too. Hmm. Auto technician Joe LoCicero is the first documented Honda owner to hit that mark. He credits regular maintenance, of course, for the car's longevity. The automaker gave him a parade in that town in Maine and a brand new 2012 Accord that's actually similar in color as well to the original 1990 that he owned for reaching this milestone.
And I hope he wasn't sitting there going, oh, why'd you give me an Accord? I wanted to get an Audi.
No, I don't think the Honda people were going to give him an Audi. Yeah, right. So, but, you know, I was thinking about this too because, you know, 1990, they really didn't have those digital – well, they did, but there weren't a whole lot of them, the digital odometers.
Yeah.
There were those analog odometers,
yeah,
right? And that analog odometer probably turned from all the nines to zero, right?
That's right. So it's like a brand new car.
It's like a brand new car, exactly. So he's got two new cars now. Good for him. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.